calendar is the case of Ren Zhu versus Scott Sterling. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask that you introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument and letting us know who you represent. And if you want to adjust the podium, you may do so according to your height. And I'll give you a few moments if you want to get settled and before we begin.
Right height.
I think it's right there. Let's see.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. My name is João Medeiros, and I represent appellants Ren Xu and Baiqing Liu. This is an appeal from a judgment following a bench trial on a claim of trespass to land. I think it probably would help the discussion if the court refers to the diagram on page 3 of the appellant's brief, which lays out sort of the relationship of the parties' lots.
Can I ask you, because it seems like, in making your argument, you're assuming there's a trespass. I mean, isn't the fact of a trespass, isn't that up to you to prove that first? I mean, because we don't even get to whether it's an affirmative defense unless you prove the trespass to begin with, right?
Well, and the question then...
Is that correct, though?
It would be correct, but then we get into the question of what is a trespass. And this is sort of where we get into some of the discussion that's addressed in the reply brief. A trespass is an unauthorized or an unconsented to entry upon land of somebody who is in rightful possession of the land. In this case, there is a dock, and the dock is on my client's land, and they did not consent to it, and they actually, once they saw that Mr. Sterling had erected the dock on the land, they went over and asked him to remove the dock.
Throughout your briefing, say that the Sterlings admitted the trespass. And I went back and I looked in the answer. I can't find that they admitted it. Were there admissions?
The admission is to the presence of the dock on the land. And I think to the extent that we want to get into the semantics of whether, they admitted to the encroachment or not, the district court did find that the dock is present on Lot B. At least part of the dock is present on Lot B, and I believe that finding is on addendum page 5, paragraph 6, it's in the addendum in the district court order. I believe they do say, or the court does find, that the dock is present on the land.
Because I'm looking at paragraph 6.
Yeah, no, that, I'm sorry.
I'm looking at paragraph 4.
Addendum page 3, paragraph 8. The survey establishes that defendant's dock begins on defendant's property and extends out over lot B.
Except that in paragraph 4, she says neither party offered evidence or testimony clearly establishing the boundaries of Lake Gleason and its surrounding wetlands in regards to the meets and bounds of Lot B and Lot 3.
That is true. That's sort of, there's two lines that we're concerned with in this case. We're concerned with the property line that separates Lot B and Lot 3, and then we're concerned with the water line, essentially.
But I'm looking at paragraph 8, too, and it says, but the survey does not establish at what point the dock extends into the water of the wetlands surrounding Lake Gleason.
Yes.
And she also indicates, I mean, she's kind of critical, I think, of the survey because it only addresses the boundaries of plaintiffs' properties.
But what the survey does establish is that the dock is present on Lot B. And that is...
But it's kind of inconclusive because the paragraph before talks about the fact that there was a plat that showed that this was apparently part of that lot, I think it's number three.
Yeah.
Abuts the shoreline, that there's another survey or another plat that showed that.
So, and this is why we get into the question of who has the burden of proof as to where the water line is. But as far as where the property line is and whether the dock crosses the property line, I think the court indicates that the dock crosses the property line, but the question becomes, where is the water line? And that's where the court says neither party was able to establish where that line is. And that's sort of the critical line for purposes of whether or not it's a riparian lot. Because if the water line is on Lot B rather than on Lot 3, then what happens is Lot 3 is not a riparian lot. There's a sliver of land that separates Lot 3 from the water line, at which point the portion of the docks or there's no riparian rights that arise.
Well, as I understand it, I mean, wasn't there testimony, though, that there was a foot of water where this dock started on Lot 3,
mm-hmm.
and then it gets deeper as you go out?
But the testimony ultimately was inconclusive because the district court held that the water line goes up and down, and so there's variation. And that's where we get into the discussion of, at what point do riparian rights arise? Do they arise at the high water mark, or do they commence at the low water mark?
And here's what, I'm looking at finding number 6. Because it says, both parties testified that the dock at issue.
Is this conclusion number 6 or finding?
I'm sorry, and it is a conclusion.
Okay.
All right, but I think their findings are fact because she's saying what occurred at trial.
And I would agree that those are findings of fact,
right.
Even though they're in the conclusions.
Right.
I was just looking.
But she says that both parties testified that the dock at issue begins on Lot 3 and extends out to the water of the wetlands, and both parties testified that Lot B is underwater, the levels of which rise and recede seasonally. So, I mean, is that enough? I mean,
If
there's a foot of water on there that rises and falls on Lot 3, isn't that enough to isn't that sufficient to establish riparian rights? I guess that's a legal issue.
That is a legal issue, and the answer is no, because a swamp does not establish riparian rights. And so we have this swampy land that's under, you know, shallow water potentially that rises and falls. And that does not establish riparian rights.
Well, but
sufficient to create the right to dock out.
The swamp connected to what is clearly lakeshore.
For that proposition, I would reference the Lake Mille Lacs case that we referred to in our brief. And in that case, what happened was you had a swamp that was attached to Lake Mille Lacs.
But wasn't that an artificial harbor?
And what happens is that the land development company comes in and dredges out and creates an artificial harbor,
right,
in that location.
Right.
And the adjoining neighbors then say, well, we can dock out into this artificial harbor.
Right.
And the court says, you did not change the rights that existed at the time that it was a swamp. And so if the rights at the time it was a swamp did not give you the right to dock out.
All right, but we don't have those facts here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I mean, it's always been wetlands that abut or that connect to a regular lake, right?
It as was until the harbor was dredged, as was the case
in
that
case.
But
they created an artificial connection to the lake.
Yes, but it but
and,
if
and
the
Mille Lacs, isn't that a pretty distinguishing fact from what occurred here?
It wouldn't be a distinguishing fact because this court said that the dredging of the lake didn't change the relative rights of the parties. And so if the neighbors didn't have riparian rights when it was a swamp and the dredging of the harbor wouldn't create riparian rights, then the neighbors won't have riparian rights when it's an artificial harbor. And so under the Mille Lacs facts, they wouldn't have been able to dock out across that swampland to reach Lake Mille Lacs when it was swampland. The same thing here. They're not able to dock out across the swamp to reach Lake Gleason while it's swampland.
But we have evidence in the record that Lot 3, at least according to one survey, abutted the lakeshore.
And
I mean, that's
what survey?
Or at least there was the Hennepin County owned the water flowage and the wetlands.
So the water and water flowage is an easement.
So there's nothing artificial here.
Is this what the original plat said was original lakeshore? But I think that would be ambiguous because they also reserve a flowage easement over Lot B. So it could have been original lakeshore prior to the development, or it could have been original lakeshore at some other point. I don't think that...
The record is silent, so we don't know.
The record is silent. That happened in 1937, and I'm assuming that we can't call in the witnesses who were involved in platting the lots originally.
So which of the judge's findings of fact are clearly erroneous?
None. Because the error occurs with respect to a conclusion of law. And this is sort of where we are. The judge finds that neither side conclusively establishes whether Lot 3 abuts the water. That's...
Well, can I ask you this then? Okay, if that's your position,
yes.
You will agree, would you not, that if, in fact, someone has riparian rights... that it would not be a trespass. Isn't that
correct?
And
the
question,
yes, this is a correct statement of law. The question is who has the burden of proof on whether riparian rights exist, and that's the issue that we've raised in this appeal. Our position is that the assertion of riparian rights is an affirmative defense to a claim of trespass to land.
But aren't you shifting your burden and showing a trespass to the other party?
For this, I would refer the court to the Danielson versus Kailonen case. And this is a 1910 case where a person has, the landowner has a fence on his land, and somebody comes onto the land and knocks over the fence. And the landowner sues for trespass. The defendant says, I had a right to come onto your property and knock over that fence because there's a public right-of-way there that the fence was interfering with. It proceeds to trial, and the district court enters judgment at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief against the plaintiff, saying you didn't meet your burden of proving a trespass. You didn't meet the burden of proving that the fence wasn't on the right-of-way. And what the Supreme Court does is reverse and remand for further proceedings, saying, no, because the party entering the land set that up as a defense to the trespass, to the unconsented entry onto land, that was an affirmative defense, and they bore the burden of proof. So go back, and they have to meet their burden now. Here we had a full trial. We didn't have an interrupted trial. And so Mr. Sterling already had the opportunity to attempt to prove that the water abutted his lot, and the court said he didn't prove it, any more than the court said that we didn't prove it. And so the question then becomes, who has the burden of proof? Because at that point, when neither party's met a preponderance of the evidence, the decision goes against the party with the burden of proof. And in this case, because the riparian rights are set up as an affirmative defense, the decision would go against the party asserting the defense, which is Mr. Sterling, which is why we would ask for reversal on this case.
Is this statement by the district court judge right or wrong? And it's in conclusion 7. The evidence tends to demonstrate that both plaintiffs and defendant are riparian owners. Both parties have non-exclusive rights to the use and enjoyment of the wetlands and waters of Lake Gleason.
That would be an incorrect statement, but it's a conclusion of law that follows from the finding that...
It would be an incorrect statement?
It would be, because the evidence would not... It's a conclusion that follows from the district court's finding that our clients, or that the plaintiffs did not meet the burden of proof. Because the burden of proof was misapplied, that would not follow.
So both plaintiff and defendant are not riparian owners?
No, our position is only that the plaintiffs are riparian owners. Because Mr. Sterling did not meet the burden of proving that his land abuts the water, he would not be a riparian owner.
You said earlier the water level goes up and down, but how much?
I believe that it can vary by about a foot.
I thought it was more like a tenth of an inch.
Tenth of an inch, but it may be a significant tenth of an inch here as well, because now we're getting into sort of what the weight of the evidence is, which is not an area that I visited because obviously we're here on appeal. The tenth of an inch crosses 940-foot line, and I believe the diagram on page 5 of the appellant's brief, it's a faint orange line. Mm-hmm. But if you see down here, it has the 940-foot line.
I do see that. I guess that
farther out.
It appears there's about a tenth of an inch between the high water mark and I think the average water level. I'm not sure about the low water.
And the record doesn't indicate what the low water mark would be.
I also had a question about Exhibit 27, the one depicted there. Whose exhibit was that?
That was the defendant's exhibit, I believe. And to be honest, I mean, I went on the website and I could make the increments without all the color and it would be easier to read, but obviously we're bound by the exhibits that came in.
I can see that orange line, at least in some places on mm-hmm. the diagram and so on. But I guess I'm wondering...
And I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Could I inquire a little bit further? So you like this exhibit, right? It tends to show that the 944 line is beyond the boundary of lot 3, right?
Correct.
And so I'm wondering why that doesn't decide the case by itself, regardless of who has the burden of proof.
Well, I would argue that it probably does decide the case by itself, but ultimately it was for the district court to resolve that, and I'm not going to argue that the district court was clearly erroneous there, because that's not what we pursued on appeal. But I think that the evidence was going in either direction, and the district court ultimately had the ability to determine what evidence it was persuaded by, and it determined that it was persuaded by none of the evidence. And then the question is, where does the tie go to? And in this case, because our clients were not asserting an affirmative, or Mr. Sterling was asserting an affirmative defense, he had the burden of proof on that, and the tie goes to the plaintiffs. And
well,
I'd ask the court to reverse and remand.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Julia Nierengarten. I'm here on behalf of respondent Scott Sterling. I'd like to pick up on a line of questioning that Your Honor started out with appellant, and that is specifically that regardless whether Mr. Sterling asserted an affirmative defense, plaintiff still has the burden of proving a trespass in this action. And what the district court found is that the plaintiff did not do that, that they did not show the unlawful entry element of the trespass. It gets a little complicated in this case because this is not a simple, like, plain vanilla trespass where I step over my property line onto your property line and...
Well, can I just stop you? Because I just want to understand what the law is and make sure that I do understand what the law is. The judge found that nobody truly established the boundaries.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
But the judge did take or give credence to the testimony of your client.
Correct.
That the dock started at the point where there was a foot of water on his property, and that it went all the way out, and that the water got deeper as the dock went on until it got to the non-wetland area of the lake.
Correct.
Is that enough?
Yes.
Is
that
enough?
In this case, it is.
To establish, and why?
Because riparian rights attach at the shoreline. And if plaintiff doesn't come forward with evidence showing that the boundary line is not somewhere beyond the shoreline, which is where our client believes it is, then it's enough for us to come forth and say, the water touches our property. Under Minnesota law, this gives us certain rights to access the water, which includes wharving out into the lake, which is what we've done here. If plaintiff doesn't establish where the boundary of the property is, it's not my client's burden to come forth with evidence that rebuts a showing the plaintiff didn't make. The determining analysis of who is the ultimate winner in this case is which side has the more convincing evidence, which side has the greater weight of the evidence in favor of their position, right? If we're talking about it as an affirmative defense. If plaintiff comes forward with a survey that does not purport to show the borders of lot 3 as compared to lot B, that does not purport to show where the water line is along lot 3, that does not purport to show where the wetlands are along lot 3, then my client should not have to come forward with more evidence beyond his testimony and corroborating testimony of another witness that the water touches his lot. It's about the greater weight of the evidence. If the court finds that our testimony that the water touches our lot and that the dock starts on our lot, that's enough for us to prevail on a riparian rights claim, because if our water touches the lot, we have the right to wharve out into the lake.
But the burden is significant, right, in finding the relevant facts?
Correct. But the other point here is that if the plaintiff doesn't meet his burden of showing a trespass, it cannot be the law that we have to come in and essentially disprove an element of a claim that plaintiff did not prove.
Well, I think that begs the question, I think. So your client pleaded this as riparian rights as an affirmative defense, and I must say it's one of the most well-expressed, most detailed affirmative defense pleading I've ever seen, with multiple paragraphs and so on. So why should we not just take that as a given? I mean, generally, things that are stated in pleadings, the parties are bound by their pleadings. Why should we look any further if the defendant assumed the burden of establishing this affirmative defense?
Well, because an erroneous pleading of an ordinary defense as an affirmative defense cannot convert what would typically be an ordinary defense, which is to say a defense that negates an element of the claim, into an affirmative defense, which is a defense that essentially admits the allegation but has an excuse to avoid liability.
You argue that in your brief, but I don't believe, did you have, is there any case law that says that, a party's pleading of an affirmative defense can be disregarded if it was, if they should have pleaded it otherwise?
I will admit that I was not able to find specific case law on that point. However, the rules of civil procedure address it in the context of counterclaims versus affirmative defenses, and our position is that it is an analogous analysis, I guess, is that we can't create a system whereby a defendant, by perhaps excessively pleading an ordinary defense in an effort to make clear how baseless the claim is, somehow changes the burden of proof at trial, somehow assumes that burden on himself to affirmatively disprove an element that plaintiff is now relieved from proving.
I mean, that would be an exception to the general notion that parties are bound by their pleadings. Things that are pleaded are taken as true and conclusively established.
I mean, I don't think that there's any argument that we're not, that anything we've pleaded in there is necessarily incorrect. It's just a matter of whether that pleading shifts the burden of proof at trial, whether we as a party can change the law about who has the burden at trial by pleading it affirmatively versus pleading it as an ordinary defense.
I mean, it has the potential of changing the pretrial proceedings. In other words, a party, you know, a plaintiff that sees that in the answer might decide, okay, now, you know, I don't need to get a survey of Lot 3. I can allow the defendant to do it or not do it. But if on the other hand, if the plaintiff believed that it bore the burden of proof ultimately, it might, you know, seek under the discovery rules, permission to do a survey, to order a survey, or to compel it, and so on. But so, I mean, it seems a little bit late in the day for respondent to say we didn't have the burden, even though we said so at the beginning of the case and never changed our position throughout the case.
But I will ask both of you this: you assert in your brief at page 8. That appellants never argued the burden-shifting theory to the district court, either in their closing brief or motion for new trial. Is that, and I'll ask appellant about that too, whether or not that's a true statement.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's, you know, another point that I'd like to make here is that this appeal is the first time that this issue is coming up in this case. Now, whether the plaintiff truly believed from the beginning that it was relieved of all burden to establish a trespass and that it was solely on the defendant, in this case, to affirmatively prove riparian rights,
didn't the judge find that both parties had proven that they were riparian owners?
Yeah. Well,
does it really matter if the judge found that both parties were riparian owners?
I'm sorry, does what really matter?
I guess I'm not understanding the argument, and I'll be asking the appellant about this. But in that, in conclusion 7, I think it's a finding, the evidence tends to demonstrate that both plaintiffs and defendants are riparian owners. Both parties have non-exclusive rights to the use and enjoyment of the wetlands and waters of Lake Gleason.
Yes.
I mean, does it really matter if the greater weight of the evidence showed that both were? I mean, how can we as a reviewing court overturn that, I guess?
You can't. That's our position, is that you can't. The court found, based on the evidence presented at trial, and if you look at the evidence presented at trial, the court's findings and conclusions reflect this. The evidence tends to show that both parties are riparian owners. Now, of course, plaintiff had the opportunity to, upon hearing the defendant's evidence of their riparian ownership, which was their testimony that the lot touches the water, could have come forth with evidence saying, actually, you can't prove that because I've got this survey or whatever. You know, there are, it's not that defendant has the last word on whether it has riparian rights. Plaintiff still has the opportunity to say, if he truly believes that we have the burden of proof, no, actually, here's documentary evidence that while you think your property touches the water, it actually does not. So it's not as though there's no opportunity for them to overcome this affirmative defense to present other evidence that weighs in the opposite direction of our testimony. But the court ultimately found, and the court, you know, as a trial tried to the court itself, the court is the fact finder in this case. The court found that the evidence tends to show that both parties are riparian owners. The court found that the testimony that our lot touches the water was credible. The court found that plaintiff's testimony that his own lot was under the water of the lake was credible. And so our position on this appeal is that this court can't overturn that ruling because it's a factual finding and the evidence supports it.
Well, assuming the burden of proof is properly placed, right? I mean that's built into your argument, isn't it?
It even if riparian rights are an affirmative defense, the court has made sufficient findings to support that conclusion, even if you shifted the burden of proof. So.
But I think that your opposing counsel argued, and it makes sense to me, that the burden of proof that the district court was operating under was the lens through which she analyzed the evidence, and so a lot of the predicate findings that preceded that conclusory statement in conclusion 7, a lot of those predicate findings are caused by, or that they came about because of the burden of proof that she was applying. Isn't that true?
Well, that argument can be made, but I will say that it still follows that even if we have asserted an affirmative defense, the plaintiff still has to prove the elements of his claim. He still has to prove the unlawful entry. And the part of the reason this is difficult in our case is because the unlawful entry and the riparian rights sort of come into this at the same moment in time, right? So if the water touches our property, we have riparian rights that allow us to wharf out into the water, that allow us to access the entire surface of the lake, et cetera, et cetera. That would negate the unlawful entry element. Essentially, if they don't show that their property somehow separates Mr. Sterling's property from the lake.
And I'm trying to understand, and appellant, I'm sure you're going to address this, but I'm trying to understand, where is there a shift of the burden of proof with regard to riparian rights? I think what the court said is, as the moving party, they have the burden of establishing defendant's entry as unlawful by the greater weight of the evidence.
It's
typical law for trespass.
Yes.
But both parties were trying to prove they were riparian owners as part of the trial.
I'm not sure that's what plaintiff was trying to prove. I don't think there was any dispute that plaintiff was a riparian owner in this case.
But both parties were asserting that.
Yes. And
that was a clear issue in the trial, and the court found that both parties were.
Yes, were riparian owners. And...
So, but that doesn't, I mean, I don't know how that relieves, I guess I'm not understanding how that shifts the burden, because in order to prove trespass, you still have to show it's unlawful.
I agree. Our position is that because we presented evidence that our property touches the water, that negates the unlawful entry element of his trespass claim. I mean... And it, so these two things, you know, I don't want to get into hypotheticals, but, you know, as we all know, trial is a back and forth. It's an exchange of testimony and evidence, and, you know, plaintiff gets an opportunity to put on his evidence and examine his witnesses, and then we get the opportunity to cross-examine, put on our own witnesses, present competing evidence, and then the court has to determine, well, which evidence is more persuasive. And in this case, the court concluded that the evidence that Mr. Sterling's lot touches the water, and therefore he by virtue of that fact, is a riparian owner and has the right to wharf out into the lake, that testimony was more credible and convincing than the testimony that he had trespassed on Lot B.
Could I ask one more question, please?
Yes.
If we were to accept your argument that we may set aside your pleading, then it still begs the question, I think, about under the law, which party bears the burden of proof about those riparian rights. So your opposing counsel has cited the Danielson case, and both in the brief and argued it orally, and it seems to be a case in which the Supreme Court seems similar. The Supreme Court reversed with respect to burden of proof in a trespass case and said the defendant has the burden, as it's represented in the brief. But you didn't respond in your responsive brief. I'm wondering if you have a response to that case.
So Danielson is actually, appellant's counsel stated during his argument, Danielson was a case where the court granted essentially a directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case, saying that they had not met their burden of establishing a prima facie case of negligence, of trespass. There are a few differences, but really what it boiled down to in Danielson was that the court reversed the district court's entry of a directed verdict in that case because there was undisputed evidence that the fence was on the plaintiff's property. The court essentially concluded that showing the exact location of the fence, or failure to do so more specifically, was not a failure to establish the prima facie elements of a trespass claim because the defendant in that case had admitted that he went onto the property and knocked the fence over. And there was no dispute that the fence was on the plaintiff's property. And so the court essentially determined that the district court improperly concluded that that wasn't enough to establish a prima facie element of unlawful entry. What the ultimate result would have been is, you know, not in the decision because the case was decided at a directed verdict stage. And that's not what we have here.
But does the opinion reflect either a holding or an assumption that the defendant bears the burden of proof if the defense to trespass is that the person had a right to cross onto the plaintiff's property, that burden is in the defendant? Is that the holding?
I would have to dig out my
right
copy,
don't do that.
Which I don't want to do right now. But my recollection of the holding is that it is the party with the burden of proof that has to come forward with the evidence establishing that at trial. So whether that's the defendant or whether that's the plaintiff, you know, in this case, it was an affirmative defense that he had a right to go on there to, you know, that he had, by virtue of the public right-of-way easement, he could go on there and take down the fence. I mean, I think we're not talking about a public right-of-way easement. We're talking about a riparian owner, a right that is gained simply by virtue of your property touching the water.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask you to affirm the district court order. Thank you.
So did you argue the burden shifting theory at the district court level?
Your Honor, no. We didn't. I don't recall that being in the final papers that were closed, but I think the point that Judge Johnson raised is well taken on that, which is that because it was in the answer pled as an affirmative defense and at no point during the proceedings was it indicated that it was otherwise than that, there was no reason for plaintiffs or the appellants to have anticipated that they needed to make that argument and prove that up.
Can I ask you, is this statement that as the moving party, plaintiffs have the burden of establishing defendant's entry as unlawful by the greater weight of evidence?
And that was my first point here that I started three times, is this idea of unlawful entry.
Isn't that just the essence of a trespass, though, that you would have that burden?
If the court will look at our reply brief for this analysis, there's some iffiness in the way that this the elements of trespass have been framed in some of these cases. The line of cases that is this unlawful entry language is taken from, we trace it back. None of those cases involved the question of the burden of proof. If you follow it back far enough, what you see is that our trespass to land comes from the common law, and that the common law Latin essentially gets translated by the courts some different ways, but primarily it's an unconsented to entry. So you enter my land without consent, and sort of the technical common law phrase was the breaking of the close. So you break the close to enter my land, that's a trespass, as long as I'm in lawful possession of the land. There's no question that my clients were in lawful possession of Lot B, and you can break the close by going in. It doesn't matter the instrumentality. The law sets up an invisible fence around it, an invisible close, even if you don't have a physical one. And so what happens is the erection of a dock across the property line is the breaking of the close. It is the trespass, and that's the point at which we've made our prima facie case. At that point, if they want to assert an affirmative defense, that's where they have to sort of say, yes, but we had the right to do so, and we had the right to do so because our land abuts the water. And at that point, that is an additional fact that they need to prove up.
All right. Well, here's the other part I don't understand about your argument.
Is
paragraph six, as I look at that, it looks like the judge is saying, okay, you're the moving party. You have the burden to prove trespass. And I've looked at this evidence, and you didn't prove the boundaries. No one here proved the boundaries. I'm not satisfied with the evidence that anyone proved anything about the boundaries. But both parties testified at trial that Lot B is underwater. And for me, that's enough. I mean, that's enough for me to find that both parties are riparian owners. And in light of that, that they both have the right to the enjoyment of the wetlands and the waters, and that therefore there can be no unlawful entry.
And
so I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure how to fit your argument within that analysis. I mean, is that analysis right about what the court found?
Well, and I think, and I mentioned this I think earlier, and I'll sort of go at it again. There's two lines that are at issue here. There's the boundary line between Lot 3 and Lot B. And that one, there is no dispute that boundary line exists and that the dock crosses that boundary. And then there's sort of the line between land and water. And that's the one that there's inconclusive evidence to. And so that's the one that determines whether riparian lot rights exist or not. And that's the one where neither party met the burden of proof on.
Is it enough, and I'll ask the same question I asked the respondent, is it enough that they show that it's underwater? I mean, that the Lot B is underwater, and I mean, as a matter of law, if you can show that the wetlands are underwater, that the water abuts or goes into Lot 3, or to Lot 3, is that enough to show riparian ownership rights?
And the answer is no, and that goes to the discussion that we had about Lake Mill Lapse and the difference between sort of a swamp on the edge of a lake and the actual lake, the high water mark and the low water mark, because that foreshore band between the high water and the low water mark doesn't give you riparian rights. It's owning the far edge of the band that abuts the water, which is what the district court said, that would give rise to the riparian rights. And that's when the district court says the land, whether or not defendant's property abuts the water of the lake as opposed to the water of the wetlands, that's the point that the district court is looking for, and the district court finds that neither party proved. And this wasn't that sort of question of where it arises wasn't sort of raised in a notice of related appeal. The district, we agree with the district court on that, that sort of principle. And I think we're sort of bound by it once we get to here because that wasn't challenged, but I think it is a correct statement of the law. Now, what I would say sort of as a final point on the idea of whether this is a affirmative defense or not, if my clients had gotten to the end of the day, end of their case in chief, and said, the dock is on lot B, case closed, we rest, and the respondent had gotten up and said, we offer no evidence, Your Honor, we rest, and nothing was said about, you know, riparian rights, there would be no question that our client would be entitled to judgment. The fact that they had to come in and introduce evidence and prove up the fact that they were a riparian owner is what makes it an affirmative defense, and that's the reason why the district court misapplied the burden of proof and should be reversed.
May I, Judge Hooten, ask one more question? Yeah. In your conclusion, you say that you asked the court to reverse and remand for determination of damages and an injunction. If we were to agree with you that there was reversible error, wouldn't it be appropriate to remand for essentially either a new trial or for the district court to analyze the evidence again, make amended findings and conclusions by applying a different standard, a different burden of proof?
The application of the burden of proof is a question of law, and so at that point the facts are what the facts are what the facts are. Both parties are now bound by the court's determination that nobody met sort of a preponderance of the evidence standard and was able to prove that up. So I think that at that point it's just a pure question of law on which side had the burden of proof. To go back further and say that you need to reverse or vacate essentially either of those findings, I think goes beyond the standard of review.
Okay, now that's, I think you're getting to the essence of what my question is. Where in this order is there an indication that this court basically thought that neither party or either party did not meet their burden of proof? And I guess it's the evidence is more likely than not supportive that they're both riparian owners.
So
where in this order would you point to that?
So I would say that the statement that no evidence was presented, and this is paragraph 6, conclusively establishing the boundary of the wetlands and whether or not defendant's property abuts the water, would be the sort of the key finding. Whether or not you're a riparian owner is a question of law that follows from a fact. The fact that creates that, that answers that question is the where the water is, essentially. So the court says nobody's established where the water is, so at that point you can't really make the leap to he's a riparian owner or not without resorting to the burden of proof.
But do you explain that in light of the next paragraph, which says the evidence tends to demonstrate that both are riparian owners?
Because the court assigned, and I think this is sort of the predicate fact issue that Judge Johnson was discussing, which is the court said that because we had the burden of proof and we failed to meet the burden of proof, the court assumes the contrary fact to be true, which is that that the water abuts his lot, and therefore he is a riparian owner, which means that the evidence tends to show that both parties are riparian owners. And so it's a fact that follows from the application of the burden of proof, because the fact that he is a riparian owner is a conclusion of law that follows from the factual finding that he is that the water abuts his lot. And that factual finding depends upon the application of the burden of proof in this case because the court wasn't persuaded by either party.
Well, can I give you when I read this, and mm-hmm. tell me how I'm wrong, I read this as your boundaries and your surveys didn't prove anything to me. But I heard the testimony from both parties. Both parties agree it's underwater. That's sufficient for me to find they're both riparian owners under these facts, based on the totality of the evidence.
And why
do we even get, and therefore, since I'm finding both riparian owners, both are riparian owners, I'm not going to, as the plaintiff, did not meet the burden of proof.
We're getting close to talking in circles here, but the district court found that that defendant's property does not abut the water, was not established by either party in the previous paragraph. So that's sort of the key issue. That's the point that creates the riparian rights is abutting the water. And so if neither party established whether or not his lot abuts the water, then neither party established conclusively, as a matter of fact, whether or not he's a riparian owner. And at that point, the court sort of breaks that tie by saying he is a riparian owner because plaintiff had the burden of proof. And what our argument is defendant had the burden of proof, and the tie should have been broken in our favor.
All right. Well, thank you. And any other questions?
Just note that neither of you tried this case.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you. We appreciate your assistance in helping us resolve this matter. We will get a decision out in the near future. Thank you.
All right.
And we are recessed now for the morning calendar.